You hear that? Your dog knows spring is coming sooner than you think. Dog walks, dog parks, playing fetch, all the stuff your dog loves to do with you. But the warmer weather also means that fleas and ticks are coming back. Fleas and ticks are in the grass, in the woods, and even on their dog friends. Fleas are an itchy nuisance, can easily get into your home, furniture, and beds, which can be terrible. Ticks are even worse. They're hard to spot, but can carry disease and get your dog really sick. PetMeds has your furry friend protected with the best products to prevent flea and ticks all year long. PetMeds pharmacists connect directly with your vet to save you time and deliver the best products for your pet. PetMeds offers low prices on all flea and tick meds, including NexGard, Simparica, and more. And PetMeds AutoShip helps you save even more with additional discounts on regular shipments of PetMeds, dog food, and other high-quality supplies. So get ready for all the spring fun now. Visit PetMeds.com and use promo code PODCAST to save 40% on your first auto ship order. That's PetMeds.com and promo code PODCAST.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, everybody. This is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. My producer is Patrick Antonetti. Two guests this week, one topic. I've been looking forward to doing this for a while. It is a podcast on covering Serena Williams, the not arguably, in my opinion, the greatest women's tennis player of all time. Apologies to the Steffi Graf fans out there who certainly have an argument. And I have two writers, longtime friends as well, who covered Serena Williams' entire career, who are two of the greatest tennis writers to ever grace pages. That's no hyperbole. John Wertheim is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated, senior correspondent for 60 Minutes, and a senior analyst for the Tennis Channel, multiple best-selling books as well. He is joined by Scott Price, who worked for Sports Illustrated for 26 years as a senior writer. His byline was SL Price, for those of you who read Sports Illustrated during those years. He wrote some of the most important stories in the history of the magazine and covered too many tennis majors to mention. He's also a best-selling author as well. His last book, Playing Through the Whistle, Steel Football, and An American Town. And we go about an hour on Serena. What it was like to cover her, what their first impressions of Serena, the kind of access that they got from Serena and the Williams family, what the dynamic was between Serena and the press, and just an overall exploration of Serena Williams as a sports subject. Again, one of the most iconic athletes of her time, and when she departs the court, which it looks like after this year's U.S. Open, it is going to leave a major void. So an hour conversation with John Wertheim and Scott Price on Serena Williams coming up on the Sports Media Podcast. All right, as I said at the top, I'm absolutely looking forward to this because it's a, not only is it a sport that I've been part of and have been a fan of for a long time, but my two guests are two people that I worked very, very close with. They are two of my favorite colleagues. They could not have been better to me in terms of mentorship and friendship. So this is a great treat for me to reconnect with them. John Wertheim is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated, a senior correspondent for 60 Minutes, a senior analyst for the Tennis Channel, a New York Times bestselling author, I believe the inventor of the Tesla as well. That's in addition to all of John's other stuff. Now, that last part's not true. And by the way, John, I have no idea if you are indeed a senior analyst for the Tennis Channel. I just like that title. Scott Price worked for Sports Illustrated for 26 years as a senior writer, running some of the most important stories in that magazine's history, including too many tennis majors to mention. Like John, he's a bestselling author. His last book, Playing Through the Whistle, Steel Football, and An American Town. That's the story of Aquippa, Pennsylvania, which has a lot of famous NFL players. But the book is really revelatory about America and sort of steel towns and particularly East Coast ones and what happened to them. And I am pleased to be joined by John Wertheim and Scott Price. Welcome to the Sports Media Podcast.
Happy to be
it's
here.
It's like old times. Good exactly. to be here. This is like a media room at Major long ago.
Yeah, if it was old times, Scott would be sending me out to do legwork and then not using that reporting.
Yeah.
That would be, yeah. 6-page tennis column. Scott, I just gave you 15 hours worth of work. How come there's not anything in here? Okay. All right.
They were incredible files, that I can tell.
Thank you. Yeah. All right, John, I want to start with you and then we'll go to Scott. Very broad, John, writ large. Can you give the listeners some perspective on how long you have covered Serena Williams?
Oh man. Don't start with me. I've covered Serena Williams since Richard Williams said, you think Venus is good? Well, I've got a younger one who plays tennis comparably well, but she's going to be better because she's meaner, which to me is one of the great sports prophecies. But no, I mean, when Serena won that first U.S. Open in 1999 in the 90s, hard as that is to believe, Scott wrote a brilliant piece, and I think you and I were doing legwork for him that day.
Scott, I'm going to get I'll get to that piece because it's, I think, very important as part of this conversation. And that's the September 20th, 1999 issue of Sports Illustrated. For those of you who are real Sports Illustrated fanatics, Serena's on the cover. Little sister, big hit. That's her first Sports Illustrated cover. But Scott, you know, you were covering tennis for Sports Illustrated back then. So I wonder, do you have any memories of writing about the Williams sisters prior to that major win? I know Venus was profiled, I think, at 14, but that may have been Sonia Steptoe or someone else. Do you remember when you first started writing about them?
Well, yeah. I mean, my first exposure writing about them was the 97 U.S. Open when Venus, you know, barreled through the draw and went and all the way to the finals and against Hingis. And, you know, one of the extraordinary things about that was, aside from everything else, just from Sports Illustrated's perspective, was, you know, almost never did the U.S. Open winner get on the cover because it was football season, NFL season began. And secondly, she lost and she was on the cover. But the fact is that she was on the cover with Venus. Venus Envy was the cover. And that was where she and Richard and the Williams family, like, sort of came full flower onto the tennis tour. Obviously Venus had been around for a while as a sensation, but this is where she really announced herself as a force. And Richard, of course, was spouting off, and that was the slam of the infamous Spurlea bump. And it was just chaos, which is wonderful for a writer, of course. And, you know, very soon after that, I think it was later in the year of 97, I went off and did a bonus on the Williams family, and it was driving around South Florida with Richard, and he was driving with no hands and smoking. And I actually showed up, you know, at the house. The compound is overstating it, but their home in Palm Beach, West Palm Beach. I at the time had an old 1960 Plymouth Fury with push button transmission and a big fin, and that was my car. And Richard Williams, you know, loved it. I absolutely loved the car. So it was a great little intro. And, you know, I was obviously watching him coach Serena and Venus on the court. Spent time with the family. I don't think I spent much time with Orosine then. But that was a big story. And of course, you know, Richard was this dominating presence at the time, and he sort of sucked up all the air in the room. And, you know, you had to talk to Richard at all times after almost every match, because who knew what he would say. He was talking about, that was the era where he was talking about, like, buying Rockefeller Center and just all kinds of crazy things. And like a month and a half after I was at his house, my younger brother came to visit me in South Florida. I was living in Miami at the time, and he was driving. I gave him my car to have for the day while I was working at the Miami Herald. And he was driving along Ocean Drive in South Beach. And he comes to a crosswalk, and this large African-American man is going across the crosswalk, and he suddenly turns And my brother was not a tennis fan, but even if he was, there's no reason why he would have known who Richard Williams was. And the man turns and says, "Hey, where'd you get that car?" And my brother says, like, he's kind of like, what's happening? He goes, "Well, it's my brother's." And the man then kind of looked at him and squinted and said, you tell Scott, Richard Williams said hello. And then he turns and walks off. So that was my Richard loves my car story. That was my original sort of introduction to Williams' world. Off we went from there. And then 99, of course, was when Serena broke through. And at that point, you know, it was the doors were off and everything was full speed ahead.
All right. So this is good. It's a very good segue there. By the way, John Wertheim, Venus Envy, one of the titles of his book, I believe, on the 2001 season. Man, that, you know, I will say it's like flashbacks now flowing through. I remember all the press corps following Richard everywhere, like early on, and like he literally was like on the back page of the New York Post. It felt like every day because he was saying things. It's just like very, very different than the Serena Williams you sort of think about today. Obviously, as she's a mother now and deep in her 30s. Okay, September 20th, 1999. As I mentioned, that's the cover of Sports Illustrated. Serena breaks through, wins her first major, beats Hingis 6-3, 7-6 to become the first African-American since Arthur Ashe in 1975 to win a Grand Slam singles title. First African-American woman to do it since Althea Gibson in 1958. This is a monumental seismic moment in tennis. And let me quote Scott Price here from his story. "Historic shifts hit tennis like hurricanes. You see them coming, but never know exactly where or when they'll make landfall. Suddenly at this Open, the future came blowing in. Steffi Graf had retired a month earlier. Fellow veteran Jana Novotna announced midway through the tournament that she'll be following suit at the end of the year. And stalwarts such as Arantxa Sánchez Vicario and Mary Jo Fernandez folded before the quarterfinals. The new generation is here and it's ready to take over," Novotna said at her retirement press conference. "I think those players will be great and they'll be tough as well." Prophetic words from the late Jana Novotna. May she rest in peace. John, when Serena broke through, and this again is pretty early, I think, in your tennis covering career, did you have any sense as to what would come? I can honestly say I did not. I thought she'd be an excellent player. In a million years, I would have never expected what happened next. But do you have memories, John, of that 1999 U.S. Open?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking, I got a call earlier that year saying, "Get to Florida," which must have meant Price was off doing something else, because I was, I was a junior partner. Venus and Serena are in the latter rounds of this Lipton event. And if they make it into the finals, that could be a big story. And you sort of roll your eyes. And this was a different era in media where you could take risks like this. And if either of them had lost, I would have flown right home. But it turned out, remember, they played in the final of that event, as Scott referenced. That was when Richard Williams held court. And digression, we can talk about whether that was by accident or by design, when he was talking about writing funny books and buying Rockefeller Center from the Chinese peoples. And everyone sort of scribbled and smiled. Did that take some pressure and some attention away from his ascending daughters? So by point being, by 1999, we already knew these were eventual champions. The conventional wisdom, though, was that Venus, the older sister, was going to break through first. She was the one that beat Serena in that Miami event, and she was ranked higher and, you know, had whatever it is, you know, almost 2 years older. And so I think everyone thought, and had been to the U.S. Open final 2 years prior, like Scott talked about. So I think everyone knew by this point the Williams family was going, you know, this was a real thing. This wasn't tennis myth-making. This wasn't sort of sports narrative. These were future champions. Did anyone say, boy, the two of them are going to combine for 30 majors and be the two best players in the quarter century? No, but I think by this point, everyone knew this was for real. The only difference was Venus was the one that was supposed to break through first. And I think one thing that gets lost with Serena in that 99 U.S. Open, I just pulled this up because so I'm cheating here. Here are her last five opponents: Clijsters, Conchita Martinez, Monica Seles, Lindsay Davenport, Martina Hingis. So this was no fluke.
Five Hall of Famers.
Yeah, exactly. Five Hall of Famers, five major champions. And so Serena won. She earned this one. And there is this great image that Scott writes about of Venus sitting there. She attends the finals because this is you know, this is family and this is history. But it was sort of, there was clear ambivalence. And Venus was the one that was supposed to be winning that first major. You know, the following year, she does just that and all's well. But it was a strange event. It was history, but it also was sort of the wrong sister.
All right, Scott, I have a lot for you here. I'm going to read what Andre Agassi told you about Serena and Venus, and it is fascinating to read now, 20-something years later. But let me just say this for those who are listening. I distinctly remember sitting in the U.S. Open Media Center, like, lunchroom, coffee room, and Scott Price, to his credit, said that he believed Serena would be the better player. And, of course, as John just sort of pointed out, I thought that was insane. I mean, Venus Williams looked like, you know, the next, like, athlete 3.0, absolutely. The older sister, you figured she was going to roll, win whatever, you know, 5-10 majors, and Serena might win a couple. And I distinctly remember making a bet, I think it was a coffee bet with Scott, that Venus would have been more majors than Serena. I have not paid up on that bet, Scott. I apologize, and but you have won. I have been officially declaring it today that that Scott Price is correct. Let me read you this, Scott, and then you can comment on it because it's fantastic. So this is Andre Agassi talking to Scott Price for his story on the 1999 U.S. Open, and he predicted that Serena would win this tournament. This is Andre Agassi beforehand. I thought she was ready, Agassi said, after his compelling 6-4, 6-7, 6-7, 6-3, 6-2 win over better-than-ever Todd Martin in Sunday's men's final. By the way, Todd Martin probably beats anybody else on that day. It's a bummer for him. I like her game. She and Venus are incredible athletes, but it's my belief that Serena was more ready to win a big tournament. Her second serve is a lot better, her forehand is better, and she's a more efficient mover. They're both fast, and Venus can elevate into greatness as well, but she's going to end up taking a bit more work. Scott, Andre Agassi called it, and he called it when Serena was 17.
Well, let me just say something about, you know, our bet. You know, Andre wasn't alone. I mean, the reason I felt secure in making that bet, I mean, you know, I was smart enough to talk to people who were smarter than me. And in tennis people, former players, coaches were telling me, look, you know, Venus is great, but Serena's total package, especially her transition from baseline to net, her forehand, I mean, her serve, she's just a more, not flawless package, but just, it's just put together a little bit more efficiently than Venus. So in tennis circles already, I mean, Agassi was sort of the most eloquent edge, you know, a voice in that, but she had won, I think, 16 in a row earlier in the year. As John said, you know, she obviously, you know, tore through the draw against Hall of Famers. But people who were analyzing tennis the way that, you know, on a level that I could, you know, never do, were telling me this is what we're seeing from this package that is Serena Williams. It's just a more efficient machine in many ways than Venus's. Venus's game will and can and will break down under pressure. And Serena just has flaws, has far less flaws in that regard. So just that's where that comes from. And so Agassi, again, you know, he told me that. And as I said, I mean, at that point, Agassi, he was always a tennis savant, but when he spoke about tennis, it was, I just recall him, you know, instant recall of messages of matches, you know, Davis Cup matches from like 6-7 years before, where it was like, you know, this stroke, that stroke, like instantaneous. People would ask him what happened there. I mean, he's remarkable in that regard. And again, he's so honest. He wasn't honest about himself at times, but he was absolutely blunt, honest about tennis, and he couldn't help himself. And so when he said that, I took it to the bank when it came to Serena.
All right, John. So Serena Williams wins the U.S. Open in 1999, but she doesn't go on a run, like a major run, over the next 2 years. The next 2 years are essentially like sort of establishing herself as a top 10 player. She makes the finals of the U.S. Open in 2001. Then we get to 2002. And that's Serena winning the French Wimbledon U.S. Open. The next year, she wins Australia and Wimbledon. So that's basically six majors over the course of 2 years. What do you recall about like that time with her? Because that's really where she becomes you know, sort of an all-timer. I mean, the 99 was a great win, but it did take her a couple of years. And then in 2002, that to me is like where the rocket fuel goes. And that's when she becomes the player we sort of ultimately now know her to be.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of this was overcoming, which, you know, something in retrospect is totally reasonable, even though people got impatient, which is, it's really weird to be facing your sister, who is your, you know, your partner in crime, your kindred spirit. You grew up in the same bedroom, and she's on the other side of the net when you're playing for these historic titles. And I think it took Serena a little bit of time to get over that, the awkwardness of perverting, of distorting the birth order. And once she did, then it was sort of off to the races. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot going on at this time. I mean, I think we can talk about this more broadly. I mean, one thing I love about this story is we are so past the days when the Williams sisters are polarizing and when this whole sort of these arguments about culture surface. I mean, right now it's this absolute love fest, as it should be. But, you know, in the first 5 years or so, there was friction and there were adjustments on both sides. And this was in a time when Serena had to deal with everything from the microaggressions in media to the distraction of her father, to this idea that she's got to figure out a way to beat her older sister with these titles on the line. And 2002, 2003, I think we started to get some clarity there. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, just the historically, empirically, that's when the train really got running.
I just want to say the older, and John has made this point often. I mean, they are the arguably, and I wouldn't even argue, the greatest sports story in American history, in the sense that you have not just one Tiger Woods, but two in the family, two African-Americans in a white sport, and the dynamic that you may not be able to relate to their power, their background, or their astonishing sort of march through tennis, but almost everyone understands sibling rivalry, sibling pressures, sibling situations. And the older sisterness, younger sisterness thing is the most remarkable thing about them. Mm-hmm. Let me just say this. Number one is going back to just the 99 Open. Venus, that picture of her, she had a hood on her head and she looked like she was in mourning. And when she clapped, everyone else was going nuts in her box and she was barely putting her hands together. It was heartbreaking to see, because it was one of the few times, in fact, I would argue it's the only time that we ever saw any of that tension. Now, one thing that opened up to me was, I believe that was the first time I found Orosin after the match, and Orosin is the ballast of that family, mm-hmm. the truth teller. And she just, I found her in the lounge afterwards and she talked to me at length about just how bad Venus felt. She thought that she let people down, that it didn't make sense that she didn't win first. And so that dynamic, that psychology was incredible, because we've never seen that again. And I would argue that the great accomplishment of the Williams family, beyond the Grand Slams, beyond everything else, beyond even their social march, you know, their social activism that has been so important, is, and I hate to say this because no one wants to get soapy, love. They literally, their relationship is unassailable. And there are other relationships, sibling relationships in tennis and sports, that do not survive the competition, the fever, the attention, the hype. And somehow, in spite of all that, nothing has ever supplanted in their minds the importance of their relationship. It's a credit to their parents and a credit to them that sisterhood has remained forever stronger than wins and hype and money. And I think, and this is, I have nothing to base this on except my observation, that at some point Venus made a concession to herself, which is that I'm the older sister. I'm going to not step aside, but I'm going to understand and be generous and know that she's better than me, and that's going to be okay. And I'm going to be okay with it. She had to do that, I think, to make it okay for Serena to get to the point where she then felt comfortable. Like Venus had to get comfortable first. I have no evidence of that, but I just feel like that had to happen almost. It, emotionally, logically, is the only thing that makes sense to me. So I just want to point that out, because I think that that transition is the untold part of the story. I don't know that we'll ever know it unless they really go into it someday themselves, but it's also the most identifiable. And I would argue that's one reason, even though it made us uncomfortable at first, like, why are they, you know, how can they want to beat each other? Like the fans care more than they do, or should we care? Because they don't, they're confused. So we're confused. But it really is the most compelling and human aspect of their story, and remains so, and will ever remain so. And I think it's an incredible achievement on the part of the family and the parents and everybody else.
Expand that beyond Venus and Serena, right? I mean, they're other siblings to whom they remain very, very close. And Richard and Orsine are no longer married. And yet all the sisters are close to both of them.
That's right. Yeah.
And you never heard about financial disputes, and you never heard about petty jealousy. And imagine the complexity of all this. And on the one hand, this is your younger sister. This is your parents and their methods being completely validated. This is trailblazing. This is path breaking. And yet if you're Venus and Serena, there has to be an awkwardness that it's often at the expense of your sister.
And they were known as, not, it wasn't just a reputation, they were ruthless competitors. It wasn't like they clearly wanted to take
out
the opponent, whoever the opponent was. That's what they were taught, and that's who they were. And yet what was even more important was they had to negotiate, whether it was consciously or subconsciously, how do we work this out? And they did. And it would have been understandable if they didn't. In fact, it's a miracle that they did.
I want to, those are both very interesting observations. And, without you guys having psychology degrees, I tend to agree with exactly what you were saying. John, I want to, Scott, you certainly should weigh in after John answers this, because you're part of this too. But I want to get into a little bit of sort of the coverage of Serena. John, as you know, the sport is very white and still remains white, even though there are more people of color within the sport. The press corps when Serena Williams started was overwhelmingly white. I think it's gotten a little bit better, but still that is a truism. From your observations, particularly like, let's say, Serena's first 5-10 years on tour, what were those press conferences like? And was, in your opinion, was there always an undercurrent of race in the room? Because obviously this is a person of color who's the subject of the questions, and almost everybody in the room was white, and in many times very much a white male.
Yeah, and then, you know, let's quickly point out we're three middle-aged white guys talking about this right now.
Exactly.
It was something, I mean, at first you're like, man, this is tricky to cover, and you sort of want to be conscious of the dynamic and the power imbalance. And I mean, I wrote about this a few weeks ago. I still remember Serena 1990, we're playing sort of history nostalgia here, but 1998, Serena Williams goes into the press conference. She, you know, the media corps does not look like her. And there's this dispute. Remember this, Scott? There's a dispute over the origins of the word
ghetto.
Ghetto. Exactly. Yep, you remember that?
Yep. I was there. Yeah.
And, you know, in retrospect, is this really an appropriate conversation to be having with a 16-year-old woman of color? Perhaps not. But Serena said the word ghetto has, I'm paraphrasing here, but, you know, has origins in the black community. And somebody said, no, it pertains to Eastern Europe and Jews. And there's this sort of dispute with this overwhelmingly white male press corps. And she's 16 years old. And the 16-year-old girl about the etymology of the word ghetto, which is sort of in retrospect probably not the coolest conversation to be having in the first place. And somebody brings in a dictionary, and Serena looks at the dictionary definition and says, "You have your information, I have mine." And I thought in retrospect, boy, if that wasn't a bit of foreshadowing right there. But I think a lot of the—
And John, by the way, the year before, you know, Richard, you know, that whole Spurlea incident, you know, part of it was Richard calling Spurlea a big white turkey.
Big, 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 tall white turkey. Exactly.
Yeah, so race was Richard, I mean, I don't want to sidetrack John, but I'm just saying race was almost always in the room, especially early on.
Yeah. And I also think however fraught it may have made it, you know, imagine you put yourself in there, you know, in the shoes of these two sisters staring out at a sea of, you know, pale, overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly male reporting. And I mean, again, I think, you know, I think that's a relationship that improved. I think pretty early on, both the Williams sisters sort of said, you know, enough with this tennis media, which actually worked to the benefit of Sports Illustrated. And yep. then pretty soon it was enough of the sports media.
Right. Right.
And suddenly, you know, it was, and you know, I mean, you know, notice where in 2022 Serena chose to make her retirement announcement, but quickly as you know, I think this was completely logical and rational, but as they got to be bigger and bigger stars, the interactions with the tennis media, they didn't want to talk about forehands and backhands and who you're playing in the next round. They wanted to talk about, they didn't even want to talk about sports. So very early on, the tennis media sort of fell in priority, and you would expect that. These are global superstars, you know, talking about who they were going to meet in the round of 16 was not where their priorities were.
So, Scott, let me get to you, because this, John hits on something that's pretty important. I think one of the benefits for you and John in particular, because you two were the ones who were writing the magazine stories, and the magazine stories usually afforded you some one-on-one time with the winner of the tournament, and obviously in many cases that was Serena Williams. I always thought that when it came to the sports press, the Williams sisters were incredibly good. I don't want to, you know, I'm saying the Williams sisters, I'll just include Venus here, even though this is really a covering Serena podcast. The Williams sisters and their family were very, very good with Sports Illustrated, by and large. I can remember, Scott, so many times when it would be that final Saturday or Sunday, you would get one-on-one time with Serena. And there were very few places that got that. The New York Times got that. Maybe there would be like an ESPN who got that, some major foreign L'Equipe or something like that. But Sports Illustrated was always in that loop. And I think that absolutely helped you develop a really good relationship with Serena, at least as good a relationship as can have with a press person and subject. And like you said earlier, I think going to the family in 97 probably helped as well. So I wonder if you could just sort of reflect on how you saw your individual relationship, and obviously through the prism of Sports Illustrated, with Serena over the years you covered her.
Well, it's funny because, first of all, we split the slams, number one. So, I mean, I did the US Open, I think, almost every year. But overall, John and I, and before that, it was Sally Jenkins, I split the slams. And so, you know, John obviously has this situation as well, and I'm sure. And I found her to be great. I mean, there's no question about it, but in my coverage, I felt free to criticize her, you know, especially when her behavior, I thought, you know, crossed the line. And, you know, I thought I was pretty tough on her. So there were times when I thought there was a real chill in the air. After her, I'm blanking on the year. It might be 2009, but whatever, you know, the infamous, you know, foot fault called the US Open. I went out to see, it was complete chaos. And there was not going to be a one-on-one that night. The Williams family was out of there like a shot. And I, along with, you know, the New York Post, everybody else sort of raced around to the entrance, the players' entrance of the US Open, because we figured, well, the family's come out at this point. Richard's there. If I remember correctly, Richard was there, unless I'm conflating with another of these situations. But regardless, I went up to Richard and said, Richard, well, you know, what do you think? And he said, get the fuck out of my face, you know? And so I don't know if it was me specifically, although, you know, he certainly recognized me because we often would talk about my car. In fact, we might've talked about how much he loved my car maybe 2 days before that, which was warm and fuzzy. And then the next thing you know, I'm getting, you know, this. So it, my relationship with them was not always incredibly tight, but it was always, there was always dialogue. Like, and I, you know, criticized when I thought they were wrong, and I praised when I thought Serena did great, you know. So it was weird because there's no question they knew the value of Sports Illustrated. I remember a French Open after 2009, more like in the early 2010s, I was at a French Open and Serena's agent, Jill Smoller, like just out of nowhere, sort of buttonholed me and said, I'd been doing a lot of bonuses at the time, long pieces in the back of the book. She goes, you know, this was one of those chilly periods, you know, where I thought, I've been criticizing them a lot. I'm not going to get much time this for a while now. And she came up and said, you know, I'd like to see one of those long pieces on Serena. And I was like, what? You know, I mean, I couldn't believe it. So, and what I mean by that is clearly they saw the value of wanting to tell that story, their story, even with somebody who, you know, had been critical, which I, as a journalist, completely appreciated, because the obvious instinct is, you know, I'm going to get somebody who's been, you know, completely positive about me and is on our side. You know, it's a very understandable point of view for people who are subjects and certainly those with no journalistic grounding. But overall, you know, there was an interesting professionalism about them, especially Serena and Serena's camp, when it came to the media. And obviously, you know, there was a benefit to it, but you know, I didn't even go to them. They originally came to me to do a long piece on Serena, which at a time when I had been critical, and I found that really interesting and smart, you know, in their regard, but unusual. And you know, I go back to like in 97 when I went there and did that story. Serena and Venus were writing a newsletter. And they actually wanted to know if I wanted to write for their newsletter. I kind of remember that. And I always found that both sweet, endearing, and funny. And the newsletter, I think, lasted for one issue, if we want to call that. I don't know.
You should have said yes. That would have been a collector's. Sorry. So, John, it's Scott. I appreciate that perspective. John, it is different for you though, because not only did you cover them for Sports Illustrated, eventually, by virtue of your Tennis Channel work, you would have seen them far more than Scott. I would venture to say that there are very few people who have covered the sport who they have seen in a press room or somewhere more than you. Maybe there's some, maybe Pam Shriver or whoever, maybe some ESPN or something like that. But by and large, you got to see them globally. You got to see them abroad. You saw them at the US Open. How would you, and I know it's a big question, but how would you evaluate your relationship with Serena as journalist and subject?
I'd say sort of went in waves. I mean, the one thing I think we should do is like not conflate Venus and Serena, because they are very different, and their approach to everything, media included, was very different. I got the feeling they knew what was being said and written about them a lot more than they let on. There was always, there was always a sort of, we don't read the papers. We don't hear the criticism, but I'm not sure that was entirely the case, but no, I mean, there was always a professionalism. Serena, you know, Venus, I think I always had a better relationship with, and some of that was just, you know, her career was less controversial. And, I think there was an appreciation with Venus that sort of who the people that were there early on and weren't sort of, weren't jumping on the bandwagon. No, I mean, I think Serena's very complicated. She's very tough to cover. There are some days you get her and she's charming and insightful. And there are other days where there's real sort of frost and opacity. As Scott referenced, all of this adds to the story. She's a human being. People are complex, but there have been some moments that are difficult to condone. She alluded them sort of at least vaguely. She alluded to those in this great retirement, this first person announcement. She's a tricky athlete to cover. And some of it was just, you never quite knew about the context. At some level, you learned what she responded to and what she didn't. I mean, ironically, if you ever wanted to talk tennis, it was a great way to sort of turn her off to the conversation. Serena never had any interest in talking about what she did for a living. If you wanted to get a great response out of her, you know what you would ask about? Venus. You've never seen someone, she'd light up the most when the subject of Venus came up. And you sort of learn these, you know, you learned what paths to go down, and the way you phrased a question or the way you phrased a statement was very important. And the other thing too is just her level of celebrity got to be such that it wasn't like dealing with any other tennis player. And there was this orbit of celebrity, and this, some of this was just celebrity and handlers and publicists, and others were just sort of the way you approach people who have this many requests and this many pressures. But no, I mean, there was always a level of professionalism with Serena. I just think that, you know, the tennis became less important, and the demands of media, I think, got to her pretty early on, actually.
And John, you may agree with this or you may disagree, which both would be interesting, especially if you disagree. I found, especially later, once it was clear that Serena was, you know, one of the all-time, if not the all-time greats, it might even be after, you know, you had declared her, you know, on the cover of SI, I think it was after Wimbledon, as the greatest of all time. I mean, you know, she was by all accounts the greatest, and it surpassed Venus by leaps and bounds. And I remember a number of times reaching out to Venus, including, by the way, when I wrote the Sportsman of the Year piece on Serena, Venus was the only one who wouldn't talk to me. And I don't think it was, I don't think it was negative. I don't think it was, but I feel like Venus wanted to carve out her identity as a great player separate from, and she didn't really want, She's sort of like, I've spoken my piece on Serena. Everyone knows her love. I don't need to again talk about how great she is. That this is my feeling about Venus. If you want to talk about me and my career, I'm happy to talk about it. But there was a point where she, you know, at least for the media, unless she was in charge of the discussion and, you know, suddenly would say something incredibly endearing and great about Serena, she was not going to be, you know, in the chorus with everybody else saying how great Serena was. And I'm not saying she didn't think she was great, but I just felt there was this sort of a need as a proud athlete to say, I'm not just here to be Serena's caddy. I've got a great career going for two. And I need to tend to that. And, you know, and so I found that there was a real integrity there, because it wasn't impugning their love or affection for each other. It was more like, I'm a professional athlete. I got my thing going on here. And I found that later on to be the case. Now you may, because you say you had a
better. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my that's right. I never heard that story. That's really interesting. And I think there might be something to that. I mean, my sense is, if they wanted to do it,
yes.
If they committed, they were all in, right? I mean, you Venus agreed to do something, and you got full Venus, and she was wonderful and funny. Yep. And if they ever had to do anything under duress, you know, players don't go to these press conferences because they want to. It's part of the deal, and it's part of, you know, this is part of the arrangements. If they ever have to do anything under duress, it can be disastrous. I mean, go back and read some of Serena's transcripts, even from Wimbledon this year.
Yeah.
When part of the deal is you have to do a pre-tournament press conference. Sometimes right. They'll just eat the fine. I mean, sometimes right. They'll both just die. I don't want to do it, and find me here. Tell me where to send the check. But it's brutal. I mean, here is this an intelligent 40-year-old woman with perspective who's a mother. And these are short one word answers. And it's clear that I'm here only because I have to be here, and I'm not giving you anything.
Well,
on the other hand, when they want to do it, they're great.
And let me take that one step further. When it came to race, the most fiery, explosive issue of all, and when especially white but also African-American journalists, I found, would bring up the issue of race, and even in the most complimentary of ways, you guys are here carrying on the tradition of Althea Gibson, whatever, I found a sort of like a perfunctory, okay, yeah, I'll refer to that, but not a like not a full-on joining in the conversation, unless they were ready or wanted to speak about it on their terms. And I respected that. It was like, because these are two powerful African-American women who have been very out there on the edge of race and social justice. But it was always on their terms. So they wanted to control that narrative, especially, I think. And I found that, again, if they wanted to talk about it, it was incredibly eloquent, could be incredibly powerful. But but only when they were ready. And again, that's a great strength of mind to have in a room full of people bearing down on you.
Let me add two things real quick. This year, Wimbledon, 2022, they ask players about Roe versus Wade. And Coco Gauff, 18 years old, talks about she has a lot in her mind. And she's vigorously opposed to this overturning. They ask Serena, and she doesn't touch it.
Right.
And someone said to me, they said, don't you understand? It's part of being Jehovah's Witness. You don't take stances. Your fidelity, your faith is to God, and it's not to countries. And that's why you won't catch them singing the national anthem. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's really interesting. And then I said, you know, you sort of take a step back and you sort of say, how wonderful and how cool is it that a quarter century on, there is still this level of mystery. Mm-hmm. And Serena's reluctance to talk about Roe versus Wade, and people are still unsure. Is this strategic? Is this tactical? Does this have to do with endorsements? No, wait, it's her faith. They held back. I mean, they did not always sort of, they didn't know open whatever our cliche is in media, right? I mean, some people they play ball every time and they they open the bucket. You didn't necessarily get that with Venus and Serena, and there's something kind of it's admirable and kind of wonderful that this deep into the story there is still this level of mystery.
Check out our new NBA show Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
All right, a couple more here, guys. Let me start with you, John. I think one of the things that we've always seen in tennis, when someone makes the announcement that their time as an active player is done, whatever that final tournament is, particularly if it's a major, you get, I mean, love letters and flowers and the whole treatment, whether it was Andy Roddick or Agassi or James Blake. I mean, many times it doesn't even matter, like, the star of the player. In this case, I think it's the greatest women's player of all time. The U.S. Open looks like it may be her last tournament, although, John, you may have some more information about that. However long she is there, I would expect the love-in of love-ins at the U.S. Open for Serena, who didn't always get the adulation of that open crowd. What do you expect in a couple weeks in Queens?
I just hope it goes a few rounds so this can build. But no, you're absolutely correct. This is adulation. I think we are so beyond any point of sort of polarization. I mean, I think, you know, they were right and any doubter was wrong. The record speaks for itself. The longevity speaks for itself. This will be absolutely sort of some unmitigated love in. You hope it lasts. You hope it lasts a bit. And, you know, tennis is tough. I mean, it's not, you know, Pete Sampras won the U.S. Open, never played another match, but it took him months and months to declare he was retired. Steffi Graf played some obscure event in San Diego, got injured, never played again. So it's great that you have this love in. I think that the timing will work well. She's, you know, I mean, her history at the U.S. Open has not always been, you know, there've been some great triumphs. There've been some unfortunate moments, but it probably is right that it's her home slam and the one she won for the first time. But I think this will be an absolute Serena celebration, and other players have a chance to join in. I mean, it really, I think one of the underrated parts of this story is there was friction in the beginning, and there's no friction anymore. I mean, this is an absolute sort of titan of an athlete, and she will get the send off she deserves.
Scott, you know, a lot of times when someone as well known as Serena retires in a sport, you think to yourself, well, is this someone who might be interested in, you know, heading into broadcasting? And I cannot see Serena Williams ever being a full-time broadcaster, though I think she'd actually be a really interesting analyst, because I think her ability to describe the game when she wants to is is really, really good. Do you, my sense is, without knowing anything, and you two guys have always been closer to this than me, my sense is that Serena's future will have very little to do with tennis. How do you see it?
Well, I agree with that, but I would say that we've been predicting the Williams family future for, you know, quarter century now. And you know, nobody thought they were going to last this long and be the sort of gray heads of tennis. Like everyone, including Richard, was predicting them leaving by the age of 25. So I wouldn't say never, but I agree with you. Every indication, and John said, you know, tipped to this earlier with the Vogue magazine thing, you know, her scope is larger than tennis. I can't see her being confined to it. Can I just add one thing about the Open? I mean, what's fascinating is Serena's relationship and the Williams family relationship with the Open has always been incredibly fraught and tense. And it's only, and this is on the family's part, only on the past 5-6 years that the family really felt we're accepted and celebrated at our home slam like we should be, like a homegrown player should be. You know, blow-ups were at the Open. Venus obviously had the contentious, you know, first U.S. Open final that she contested. The family has a very fraught history with the Open and wondered, like, why here? Why are we constantly under pressure in a way that no other place is here? And it really, they really didn't feel, and they also felt we're always the overdogs under open crowds love underdogs. So they almost always were being like, why are people cheering more for Kim Clijsters than for Serena or Venus? It was a mystery to the family. And you know, they really had problems with it. So it has been a love fest, and I predict it'll be a love fest, but the relationship between the Williams family and the US Open is its own incredibly interesting and intricate story. It's unlike their history with any other slam.
John, do you, I mean, fair to say that we're not going to say hello and welcome to the Credit One Charleston Open. I'm Serena Williams joined by, like, I don't think I see that in the future personally.
Well, I think she'll be coaching a player, so she won't be able to broadcast. No, I think you're right, but I don't. I mean, part of this is just again the mystery of Venus and Serena and the who the hell knows of it, and you'll go broke if you ever try to predict anything. The other thing, I just think it's going to be interesting, sort of where they fit in, because in tennis there is a vast spectrum. I mean, there's some players as if they've never left. I mean, John McEnroe is as prominent at the U.S. Open this year as he will be when he was playing. And other players, I mean, I don't think Steffi Graf's been to a professional tennis match since she retired. So there's a continuum. There's a vast spectrum, and you sort of have to figure out how much you still want to be around this sport. It would be a pity if Venus and Serena, if they did what Steffi Graf or you know, even something like Jimmy Connors or Pete Sampras. I mean, some players have just said, I've done it. I've gone to my last luxury suite. I've gone to my last awkward sponsor function. I'm out. Other players, you know, it's hard to leave. It'll be really interesting to see sort of where they stick the fork.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, oh, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, here's the last one. And all of us sort of, you know, the one thing you don't want to get caught in is that, like, oh man, the sport can't, like, survive after Federer and Nadal, Djokovic. Oh man, the sport can't survive after Serena. Like, the sport goes on. There's always another crop of great players, and you watch the sport because you love the sport. With my preamble there, Scott, all that said, if you talk about sort of the media aspect of the sport, the broadcasting of the sport, the star power of the sport, Serena leaving is really, really a monumental thing. You know, I'm on the WTA website right now and looking at the top 10, you know, Swiatek, Sakkari, Ons Jabeur, Halep, Sabalenka, Pegula, Muguruza. I mean, again, but Bencic, Goff, all very talented, accomplished players. None of those players, by and large, are making the casual fan, like, tune in to a U.S. Open final or a Wimbledon final. And that will be another part of Serena's legacy, is that it's going to take, I think, the tour a couple of years to find whoever that next dynamic must tune in. And that is something that will end when Serena walks away. Because you look at the top 15, top 20 now, honestly, there's nobody even close to her when it comes to that kind of star power.
Well, yeah. And look, here's the thing, that the tennis in many ways was sort of ruined by the tennis boom and into thinking, or diluted by the tennis boom of the 70s into thinking that they could be, you know, a sport on par with, you know, football or baseball or whatever. This is a niche sport that is propped up in wonderful ways four times a year by these incredibly historic and grand slams that people will tune into whether their favorite player is playing or not. And you know, it ebbs and flows. There are moments, the great thing about tennis is that it constantly edges back into the cultural mainstream in a way that, say, golf doesn't, because of social issues or what have you. And so I'm more bullish on it, but I also have less expectation of the sport being, this massively popular thing. This is a niche sport that is almost hits above its weight culturally more than anybody should expect. And having said that, I mean, I would disagree with you. Just Goff and Alcaraz alone, I'm really interested in seeing what comes next, and I'm mesmerized by their power and grace and potential. So. I hear you, but I've covered the retirement of a lot of players. It's from Agassi is a perfect example. You know, what are we going to do after Agassi? He's, you know, people love him outside the sport, even if they know nothing about the sport. And how could we possibly care about a Spaniard, a Serb and a Swiss instead of Andre Agassi and ones that don't misbehave really all that badly compared to the previous generation. And yet the sport that people did. And so I'm a little bit more bullish on it than you are. But I mean, we are talking about the eclipse of the greatest woman player of all time, arguably. I mean, obviously, smaller concentration, you can argue Steffi Graf was more dominant in her era. You can argue about Martina, but in terms of this overwhelming presence, I think it's inarguable that Serena is in the conversation, if not absolutely the greatest. And when that happens, it does leave a hole. But I'm not with you that it will last as long as you think it will.
All right. So, John, you could settle this because, again, I know what's where Scott's coming from and I respect it. But I say to him, with all due respect, Federer, Nadal and Djokovic are not walking through the door in the next 5 years in the WTA Tour. I hope to be wrong, and I will still watch it because I am a fan of the sport. But I am thinking of the American consumer. And again, I look at the top 20 and I don't see it. Maybe Raducanu and maybe Goff become that, but I think we are in for 2 or 3 years of multiple different kind of major winners and it becoming, at least on the women's side, a very niche sport. But you are there every week, so I leave you with the final word.
Tennis is a big tent and it will be lacking some significant supporting poles pretty soon. But I think I tend to agree with Scott. I think the real legacy of Serena Williams is that she absolutely obliterated these notions of tennis. And we talk about, oh, it's a country club sport. And yet, I don't know, you go down the list, you know, Novak Djokovic's parents ran a pizza parlor and were chased by loan sharks. And Rafa Nadal comes from the island off the coast of Spain with this, with a hard driving uncle. And he literally Naomi Osaka, you know, that half Haitian, half Japanese. And I think that right now it looks pretty grim. This is the NBA when Michael Jordan retires. And you know what? Eventually there'll be a Kobe and a LeBron and a Steph Curry. And eventually some kid is going to realize that, hey, if Serena Williams did it, it doesn't matter that I'm not from the Shaker Heights Country Club. And I think that someone will fill this void. They're still going to play four majors a year. There'll still be stories. It's still a sport that's individual and breeds craziness and all the reasons we love to cover it. It still breeds personalities. It's global. There are enough virtues here that I don't think we're going to see anytime soon players winning 20 majors as Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, and Serena all have. I think realistically, from that perspective, it's going to be a while. But pretty soon a LeBron will come along, pretty soon a Steph Curry will come along. And I think a large part of that is because Serena Williams is proof positive that there isn't just one way to get there.
Yeah, I admire your optimism, but when Rybakina and Pliskova are playing in front of 800,000 people on ESPN, I'm going to email you both. All right, John Wertheim, you can catch. I mean, I can't even keep up with this guy's resume at this point. It grows every week. But you can find him at Sports Illustrated, 60 Minutes, the Tennis Channel. Any other place, John? Did I actually, in all seriousness, did I miss anything, or is that it right now?
Can I? We do have a fun Ohio State Michigan film coming out in a few weeks. We'll talk about that later. But no, can I just say that. It was an absolute pleasure. Seriously, all bullshit aside, this was a pleasure. This makes you realize that your colleagues are an important. They tell you about salary and they tell you about passive advancement and commuter time. They don't tell you that having nice colleagues is a huge factor in whether you like your job or not. And this was a nice reminder.
Well, I will get left before I say goodbye to Scott. Let me give a shout out to all the people who floated with us over the years, from the Drew Lawrences to the Kristen Morses to the Jamie LaSantes. And I apologize for Elizabeth Newman. I apologize for whoever I'm forgetting. But the Sports Illustrated group at the Open was always great because everybody who was there really loved it. And you have to love it in order to, stay there until 1-2 in the morning in a very empty media room with cold coffee and stuff. Scott Price worked for Sports Illustrated for 26 years as a senior writer. Check out all the great work he did. And I have now forgiven him for literally the first three years of my career, working endless hours and seeing literally one sentence of that work in the magazine. Scott Price, best-selling author as well, Playing Through the Whistle, Steel Football, and an American Town. Scott, anything you want to add before we wrap this up?
Oh, it was a privilege to work with you guys. It was a privilege to cover this great sport, and it was a privilege to watch, Serena and Venus do what they did. One thing I want to say is, the last thing is just about them. They're, you go to a U.S. Open today, and the crowd that you are walking through to get to the stadium every day is markedly different, markedly
100%.
Markedly more diverse. Markedly, more African American faces than you've ever seen. More people of color. I think it was Christopher Wren. St. Paul's Cathedral. If you're looking for his monument, just look around you. He was the architect. I mean, if you want a monument to what Serena and Venus have meant to the sport, look around when you go to the U.S. Open, because that crowd is the monument. They changed tennis. What it looks like, what it feels like, and what it possibly can be. And it was a joy to actually just not just talk to you guys, but also to remember the impact they truly had on the game.
Yeah, that's well said, Scott. All right, check out John Wertheim's work. Check out Scott Price's work. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me today on the Sports Media Podcast.
Thank you.
Together. Thanks.
All right, back in the studio. My thanks to Scott and John. They were great, as expected, and I hope you enjoyed that. I hope we could bring you something different when it came to some of the backstory of Serena Williams. If you like these kind of conversations, please, wherever you listen to podcasts, leave us a 5-star review and a nice note. That's how this podcast continues. You go through the archives, we've had some pretty good stuff lately. Joe Buck on Vince Scully, that was pretty cool. The Rise of the Black Quarterback and What It Means for America. A conversation with Antscape senior NFL writer Jason Reed, who wrote that book. Did a long form on What Happens Next with Brittany Griner, with Dr. Danny Gilbert, who is a hostage policy expert, and TJ Quinn, who has been covering that story for ESPN and covering it well. Soccer commentator Ian Dark was a recent guest on this podcast talking about covering the World Cup. Again, head to the archives. There should be conversations that you can listen to. Many of them become evergreen. And so please, hopefully you'll find something you'll enjoy. I want to thank Patrick Antonetti for all his hard work. Thank you to Cadence 13 and everybody there for their support. And most of all, thank you for listening. We'll see you soon on the Sports Media Podcast.